Truth Seekers, Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. It is Wednesday night, church night on the Malloy program. We may find some time to indulge in that little bit that we do on the program. If you get a chance, go to truthout.org and read this interview conducted by Mark Carlin.
If you're not this angry, then you're not paying attention. Back to Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, so that's what that's kind of what we're stuck with. We have one political party that is so weak-kneed and slack-jawed that it just simply can no longer fight. It is owned about. This hour is being sponsored by Chris in New York, and his message, this is a reminder to all Truth Seekers to sign up for a podcast subscription and sponsor an hour of the program. Thank you, Chris. So anyway, about the Republican Party being a party religious, it's a religious party now. There is no question about it. If you want to vote that way, go ahead. Several years ago, long time ago, I took Kathy to my hometown of Toledo, Ohio, for some event. I don't know what it was. It doesn't matter. But we drove, and we were. Before the hour, isn't religion fun? This hour has been sponsored by Chris in New York. His message, this is a reminder to all Truth Seekers to sign up for a podcast subscription and sponsor an hour of the program. Yes, that would be great. That would be great. We have some more stuff here for church night, but I will set it aside for now because I do want to move on to some other stuff. If you saw the New York Times today, you saw the photograph. Sponsored by Jason, or in the chat room, Jay Cruzen. His message to Mr. Barack Obama: Mr. President, if you would come out and openly endorse democratic socialism, this $100 that I've sent to Malloy would have been yours. You could start by nationalizing all forms of energy production, the Fed and all the Goliath banks in this country. If you need more details, Mr. President, visit Democratic Socialists of America at DSAUSA.org. Thanks, Jason. Thank you, Jason. You got that website? DSAUSA.org. This is interesting. This is from Huffington Post. Harry Reid has apparently a legal right to look at Mitt Romney's tax returns. And if that's true, and I have no reason to doubt it, it's in Huffington Post. Well, let me share it with you. It says, although Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney refuses to release his tax returns from the years prior to 2010, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, President Barack Obama, and key members of Congress could all view any tax document that Romney has filed. Under some circumstances, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid could even verify whether his anonymous Bain investor was telling the truth that Romney didn't pay any taxes for 10 years. According to Title 26 of U.S. Code Section 6103, the Treasury Secretary can disclose any personal tax return to the president, quote, or to such employee or employees of the White House office as the president may designate, end quote. Members of Congress can also access Romney's earlier tax returns by making a written request to Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Senate Finance Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, and the Joint Committee on Taxation are all mentioned as committees that can access individual tax returns. The chairman or any other congressional committee, the chairman of any other congressional committee can also obtain access for his or her entire panel, provided the request meets one caveat. Rebecca Wilkins, senior tax counsel at Citizens for Tax Justice, said, quote, a request by anyone except a tax writing committee has to be accompanied by a Senate or House resolution, end quote. Reid, for instance, is a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Senator Dianne Feinstein. Senate Republicans, however, would likely filibuster any formal resolution to see their presumptive presidential nominees' returns. But even if Reid did request and receive Romney's tax returns, it's unlikely that he would be able to share any information about them with the public. Members of Congress can see the returns without Romney's consent, provided that any committee viewing the information is, quote, sitting in closed executive session, end quote. Romney has denied these allegations, blah, blah, blah. As far as Harry Reid is concerned, he's refused to publicly name his source, but his chief of staff, David Crone, has said that Harry Reid told him, David Crone, who the source is. Reid's office told Huffington Post that he is not interested in compelling the release of Romney's tax returns through procedural maneuvering. Reid's spokesman, Adam Gentleson, said, quote, this is up to Romney, who seems to think he plays by a different set of rules. The only way he can clear this up is to release his returns, and that choice is his alone, end quote. Show us your birth certificate, Mr. President. Show us your birth certificate, Mr. President. Where's your birth certificate? I didn't see any births. Where's your birth certificate? Birth certificate, birth certificate, birth certificate. Tax returns? Tax returns? Crickets. Cheesy bastards. Pew Research Center had some bad news released today. According to the Pew Center for the people and the public and the place and the thing and the event and blah, 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 the middle class is shrinking. Since 2000, the middle class has shrunk in size, fallen backward in income and wealth, and shed some of its characteristic faith in the future, though not all of it. So starting with the stolen election of December 12th, 2000, we have gone backwards. Now, you probably feel that. I damn sure do. Everybody feels it. But here's the proof. These assessments are based on findings from a new nationally representative Pew Research Center survey that includes 1,287 adults who describe themselves as middle class. And the Pew Research was supplemented by the center's analysis of data from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Fully 85% of self-described middle-class adults say it is more difficult now than it was a decade ago for middle-class people to maintain their standard of living. Of those who feel this way, 62% say a lot of the blame lies with Congress. 54% say the blame lies with banks and financial institutions. 47% say it's large corporations are to blame. 44% say it was the Bush administration. 39% say it's foreign competition. And 34% say it's the Obama administration. Just 8% blame the middle class itself. And as the Pew Research Center says, this downbeat take on the middle class's economic situation comes at the end of a decade in which, for the first time since the end of World War II, mean family incomes declined for Americans in all income tiers. But the middle class tier, defined in this Pew Research analysis as adults whose annual household income is two-thirds to double the national median, middle class, middle income folks, are the only ones that also shrunk in size, a trend that has continued over the past four decades. There are fewer and fewer and fewer of members of the so-called middle class, is what they're trying to say here. In 2011, the middle income tier included 51% of all adults. Back in 1971, using the same income boundaries, it had included 61% of all adults. And there's all kinds of statistics here that are available if you want to go to the Pew Research Center, go to their website. I spent some time there today looking at this report, and holy Toledo, it's not shocking. The shocking part of it is to actually see it in print, to see the detailed research that went into providing these statistics. The assault on the middle class, of course, by the corporatists, the capitalists, the ending of decent-paying jobs, the tax breaks for the wealthy, the cutting of the destruction of the union, the force of unions, all of it taken together is ending. If you believe this stuff, if you don't believe it, then to hell with it. You know, close the book. Don't go to the website. Say, I'll...
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Moment with Bob coming up at the after the break at the bottom of the hour. Greg Payton, our friend from, well, he used to live in Florida. I think he's moved to Madison now. He writes for Examiner.com, and a lot of his stuff goes up at Op-Ed News and all around the net. But he sent me a little piece here that he's got going up at, it's up at Examiner.com. Greg writes, in May, when Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz called out the Republican Party for waging a war on women, many pundits thought it was just political rhetoric. Since then, the actions and public statements made by GOP politicians have confirmed her statement and may ultimately lead to the self-destruction of the GOP in the next election. Well, we can hope, right, Greg? And then he writes about Representative Todd Akin and the rest of these clowns. But Greg goes on, here are a few more examples of how the GOP is burning itself up with women voters. Well, at least those women voters who have self-respect and vote with their conscience. A state legislator in Georgia wants to change the legal term for victims of rape, stalking, and domestic violence to accuser. They're not to be called victims anymore, accuser. But victim...
All substance, no abuse.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Jason or as he's known in the Malloy chat room, Jay Cruzen. And also, happy birthday to Greg, who is our chat room monitor. He will wrap your knuckles if you get out of line. Happy birthday to Greg in the chat room. Jay's message, Jason's message to Barack Obama. Mr. President, if you would have come out and openly endorsed democratic socialism, this $100 I'm sending Malloy would have been yours. You could start by nationalizing all forms of energy production, the Fed, and all the Goliath banks in this country. If you need more details, Mr. President, visit Democratic Socialists of America at DSAUSA.org. Yours, Jason. Thank you, Jason. And happy birthday to Greg, too. Hey, Greg. All right, it is time, I believe. Once again, listen, listen. There's that music. Time once again for A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight, the subject is, this was the year that was great. And by the way, I have an abbreviated version here because of time constraints, but you can read the entire original at tvnewslies.org. tvnewslies.org. I shouldn't have to tell you to go to that site. Under editorial link, Bob Alexander. Hey, Mike! 1 year ago today, we loaded up a borrowed truck for the last time, and in the great tradition of the Grapes of Wrath and the Beverly Hillbillies, rolled on out toward a dream of a better life. The Jodes struggled along Route 66 from Oklahoma's Dust Bowl through California's Mojave Desert to get to the promised land. Jed Clampett sold his oil-rich swamp in the Ozarks for $25 million and moved his family to the hills of Beverly. Well, our move wasn't as difficult as the Jodes and certainly not as well subsidized as the Clampets. It took us 10 years to have the wherewithal to make the 2.5-hour drive from our house in Seattle to our new home in Canada. Though we woke up in a new country, we didn't have the time to appreciate it for the first 3 months or so. We still have family back in Seattle. We've gone down and back for holidays and birthdays. Every time we cross the border back into Canada, I feel great relief that we've re-escaped. A fellow American expat also residing in Canada said it best when he emailed me. He wrote, "These days, I live with the air of freedom that is, without fail, replaced by an air of repression every time I have to go back into the States. I've been leery of my government since the Vietnam War. The Reagan years convinced me it wasn't that difficult to convince millions of people to tentatively hold hands with fascism. After two stolen presidential elections, the attacks on 9/11, and the invasion of Iraq, it's obvious we've gone way beyond the hand-holding stage to fully embracing fascism. We didn't come up here for the inexpensive health care or the Chinese food. We came up here because the United States of America is closing down. And I didn't want us to get caught on the wrong side of the border. Before the Civil War, the U.S. South was a closed society. People couldn't freely explore their own thoughts to anyone or even to themselves without eventually having to face the horrible conclusion that their entire way of life was based upon owning human beings. Therefore, an arcane code of courtesy came about to keep inconvenient truths from tarnishing polite conversation. There were just some things one didn't talk about. There's quite a long list of things Americans can't talk about since the coup of December 2000. It's not polite to bring up the illegitimate warmongering president, the non-existent weapons of mass destruction, the horrific numbers of dead in Iraq and Afghanistan, the gutting of the poor and the middle class, and the fact that the criminals who committed these crimes have not been prosecuted. At the top of the list of unmentionables, if you're a so-called liberal, is the lethal presidency of Barack Obama. We can't have a national discussion about any of these things without being shouted down. The right wing goes bat crap ballistic, and the so-called liberal water carriers forcefully whine, again, about the lesser of two evils dodge. We We can talk about whatever we want to as long as we don't talk about what is going on. I don't understand how any rational American can...
If you're not this angry, then you're not paying attention. Back to Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Next hour, we're going to take a look at what historically has been done to predatory bankers and people who abuse the financial system over the past 500-600 years. And I think you're going to find it very interesting. There's a lot of blood and gore in what I'm going to, not Al Gore, what I'm going to talk to you about in the next hour. But some pretty good ideas about what to do with the people who have destroyed the middle class in this country. And once again, this hour has been sponsored by Jason, or as he's known in the chat room, Malloy chat room, Jay Cruzen. Jason writes, it's a message to Barack Obama. It says, Mr. President, if you would come out and openly endorse democratic socialism, this $100 I'm sending Malloy would have been yours. You could start by nationalizing all forms of energy production, the Fed, and all the Goliath banks in this country. If you need more details, Mr. President, visit Democratic Socialists of America at DSAUSA.org. Signed, Jason. So there you go, Jason. Thank you for the sponsorship. Indeed. Yeah, it used to be called President Obama's War of Necessity. Now it's America's Forgotten War. And have you noticed there's no mention of what's going on in Afghanistan on the campaign trail? There's a lot of garbage talk, a lot of nonsense. Barack Obama understands that he can do nothing about this economy, nothing, absolutely nothing, unless he has a House in the Senate, a House and a Senate, with veto-proof majorities where he can get legislation passed to stimulate the economy. He knows that. The Republicans know it also. So this phony-ass election coming up in November, if you are going to vote for the lesser of two evil systems, the Democratic system or the Republican system, keep in mind that if you're going to vote for Obama, you also have to vote Democratic all the way down the ticket. You have to vote for every Democrat you can think of on the federal level, because without Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate, we're going to have four more years of this. And by then, the mood to fascism in this country will be a fait accompli. There's no way to avoid this. None. Now, the other way, of course, is to stop the whole goddamn machine from running another day. But you know, Americans don't want to do that. We, by and large, are content to let this miserable, unreal itself. You know, this movie of the great, late great United States of America. It's one of those scenes where the film comes out of the reel-to-reel player. Some of you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But, yeah, a film. There used to be a thing called film. And it went from one reel to another, and before it got to the second reel, it passed through a very powerful light. Oh, never mind. Anyway, if you were the projectionist and you didn't stop it when it got near the end, it would flap out of the first reel and go flap, 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 flap. That's what's happening to the United States. The reel is running out. 80,000 American troops are still fighting and dying in Afghanistan at the rate of one a day, one American death a day, 360 a year. So many of the troops that are coming home are committing suicide. Americans are more interested in this bullcrap that's on... in these campaigns than suicide bombings. we're more attuned to this ad war that plays out on American television. Deb Reichman, who writes for the Associated Press, says, by the time voters go to the polls November 6th to choose between Obama and Romney, the war will be in its 12th year. Public opinion remains largely negative. 66% opposed to this war, 27% in favor in a May Associated Press poll. More recently, a Quinnipiac University poll found that 60% of registered voters felt the U.S. should no longer be involved in Afghanistan. 31% said the U.S. is doing the right thing by fighting there now. That 31%, of course, are people who have just had every possible bit of reasoning power sucked out of their minds. Not since the Korean War of the early 50s, Ms. Reichman writes, and that was a very short war, what, about 2.5 years, has an armed conflict involving America's sons and daughters captured so little public attention. Deb Reichman quotes a soldier, Matthew Farwell, who served in the Army for 5 years, including 16 months in eastern Afghanistan, where he sometimes received letters from grade school students addressed to the brave Marines in Iraq. He says, we're bored with it. We all laugh about how no one really cares. All the support the troops stuff is bumper sticker deep. This young man is 29. He's now studying at the University of Virginia. He said the war is rarely a topic of conversation on campus, and he isn't surprised that it's not discussed on the campaign trail. But you know what? Ignoring this war doesn't make it go away. If you get a chance, take a look in the New York Times and look at the faces of the second 1,000 American young men, young Americans, a couple of women who have been murdered and who have committed murder. Then tell yourself how proud you are of our efforts there. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Seven past the hour. Church night on the Malloy program. Did you get enough in the first couple of hours, huh? I've got a couple more. We'll see if it works then. From the BBC, this is sent to me by Lee in New York City. From the BBC, because the U.S. media is, you know, not really interested in science. Come on. Here's the headline from the BBC. Arctic sea ice set to hit record low. Oh, one of those stories again. Scientists at the U.S. Nation... start over. This time try English from the BBC. Okay. Scientists at the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center said data showed that the sea ice extent was tracking below the previous record low set in 2007. Latest figures show that on August 13th, ice extent was 483,000 square kilometers. Okay, 186,000 square miles below the previous record low for the same date 5 years ago. The ice is expected to continue melting until mid to late September. The center's lead scientist, Ted Skambos, told Reuters news agency, quote, a new daily record would be likely by the end of August, end quote. He went on to say, chances are it will cross the previous record while we are still in ice retreat. End quote, end quote, end quote, end quote. Oh, who cares for ice, right? I mean, Jesus. You know, once all the ice is gone, once it's all melted out of the Arctic regions around the globe, why, it's going to free up just millions upon millions of ocean acres that then can be drilled for more oil. It's wonderful. Capital One. You know, the ones that use the Vikings in their commercials on television. And, yeah, some of those commercials are really funny, but what Capital One does to their customers is not very funny. As a matter of fact, it's kind of tragic. I saw this the other day, and I started thinking about the grief and stress and chaos in families and with individuals that this stinking bank caused. What I'm referring to is Capital One has agreed to pay $12 million... $12 million. That's like me agreeing to pay $5 to resolve something, right? Capital One has agreed to pay $12 million to resolve allegations that it violated special consumer protections in federal law for members of the military. The military. Capital One had no problem gouging, stealing, and defrauding stealing from and defrauding military personnel. That's what the Justice Department announced this last week. The government says Capital One wrongfully foreclosed on some homes and improperly repossessed some cars. In addition, the government says the bank obtained wrongful court judgments against some military members and improperly denied interest rate relief on some credit cards and car loans. Isn't that nice, huh? In a settlement under what is referred to as the Service Members Civil Relief Act, Capital One will pay $7 million in damages, including at least $125,000 to each service member whose home was unlawfully foreclosed upon, and at least $10,000 to each service member whose vehicle was unlawfully repossessed. Capital One will also provide a $5 million fund to compensate service members denied appropriate benefits on credit card accounts, auto, and consumer loans. The feds say that this...
Still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's you.
You are now entering a flying monkey free zone. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. So given the fact that the most vicious organization on earth today are different manifestations of the banking industry and the financial services industry. I don't think there's any disagreement with that. It's not war, per se, that has collapsed the global economy for most of the world. It is not famine. It is not pestilence. It is the banks. It is the financial services industry. So... some historical context, if you will, on what to do with these sons of bitches. Maybe it's time for the peasants to get all medieval on bankers. Jason Zweig, writing at Wall Street Journal blog.
Hi, Truth Seekers. It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. You may not know this, and maybe you do, but we reached a milestone in the Afghan war. U.S. military dead the other day has hit 2,000. The 2,000th soldier who died was Army Specialist James Justice, who had just turned 21. Nine years passed before U.S. forces reached their first 1,000 dead. The second 1,000 came just 27 months later. Before the hour, just a little more here. The Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal blog site there, Jason Zweig at the Wall Street Journal, and I'm not sure who the author was at Bloomberg, but how in medieval times and more recently, the banksters were dealt with. They were tortured, murdered, beheaded, executed. Which is the way it should be, because they cause so much grief and suffering. During the so-called Good Parliament, for example, of 1376, public discontent over manipulation of currency exchange rates, which is very similar to the current LIBOR standard or scandal that's going on right now. We're not hearing much of it because we Americans are too stupid. But anyway, it all came to a head, so to speak. The Commons, represented by the Speaker, Peter de la Mer, accused leading members of the Royal Court of abusing their position to profit from public funds. A particular target was the London financier Richard Lyons. Initially, the government bowed to public pressure. Lyons was imprisoned in the Tower of London, and his properties and wealth were confiscated. Other leading courtiers implicated in these abuses, such as Latimer and the king's mistress, Alice Pereres, were banished from court. Once Parliament had dissolved, though, and the public outcry had died down, the king's eldest son, John of Gaunt, acted to reverse the verdicts of the good Parliament. Latimer and Pereres were soon reappeared at the king's side, and Lyons was released from the Tower and recovered his wealth. While the whistleblower, de la Mer, was thrown in jail. Things just remain the same, don't they? Anyway, the government also sought to appease the wealthy knights and merchants that dominated Parliament by imposing a new aggressive form of taxation, a poll tax paid by everyone rather than a tax levied on goods. This effectively passed the burden of royal finances down to the peasantry. So not only were they taxed with everything else, now there was a poll tax. Sound familiar? It seemed as though everything had returned to business as normal, and Mr. Lyons appeared to have gotten away with it. But in 1381, simmering discontent over continuing suspicions of government corruption and the poll tax contributed to a massive popular uprising called Now, this part you remember, the Peasants' Revolt, during which leading government ministers, including Simon of Sudbury, the Chancellor, and also Archbishop of Canterbury, and Robert Hales, the Treasurer, were executed by the rebels. And this time, the London financier Richard Lyons did not escape. He was singled out, dragged from his house, and had his head lopped off in the middle of the street. For some reason, I just keep seeing Jamie Dimon's face right now. Anyway, if the king had followed the rule of law at the time and kept Lyons and the boys in jail, everything would have calmed down. But the monarchy, just like what's going on right now, chose to ignore the rule of law and chose to protect the thieves and punish the whistleblowers. U.S. government, are you listening? Now, the argument is made for years that the best way to avoid violence is to reinstate the rule of law. Of course, the Republicans and the fascists and the corporatists want none of that. The Bloomberg article I'm just quoting written by a professor of the history of finance and a professor of finance at the ICMA Center, Henley Business School, University of Reading in the UK, ends on a similar note, to wit. The question now is whether public outrage at the LIBOR scandal and other financial misdeeds will lead to fundamental reforms of the financial sector, such as the separation of retail and investment banking. That would be the, I'm having another senior moment, that Clinton ended during his presidency. The separation of retail investment banking or legislation to regulate the banking culture, or just more cosmetic changes that fail to address the real issues. Will we have to wait for a 21st century peasants' revolt before seeing any real change? Eh? I have a feeling that a 21st century so-called peasants' revolt is on the horizon. Now, as far as dragging these thieves and liars into the street and beheading them, or hanging them from the nearest lamppost, it has its appeal and its charm, doesn't it? Because they're not going to reform themselves, and they own the agencies of government that could make the changes necessary. Glass-Steagall is what I was thinking about, the Glass-Steagall Act that Clinton ended. So what's left? If the government is incapable of independently bringing these bastards to heel, and if they are not going to stop their fraudulent activities, what's the third alternative? Another peasants' revolt? Beheading people in the street? Hanging them from lampposts? Locking them up forever? No, locking people up forever. We only do that to whistleblowers like Bradley Manning. We don't do it to the real criminals. The real criminals are granted membership in the Augusta National Golf Club, like Condoleezza Rice. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.